Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So let's just take a deep breath and launch into some science, shall we? So some time ago, and I discovered that when you break down a tattoo with a laser, you actually produce compounds that are actively carcinogenic. Now, that's a little worrisome. Some of the newer synthetic dyes that give us those beautiful colors actually are a bit bad for you after they've been hit with the energy of a laser beam. So they're not cancerous. They're approved by the FDA. For use, because as long as you leave them there and leave them alone, you're good. But if you change your mind and try to get rid of a tattoo, if it has those artificial pigments in it, you might be running into trouble. Now, that wasn't such a big deal, but this latest study has really got me thinking. This study came out in, September of this year, and the source was the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility, and I just love that we're using quantum physics, quantum particles to analyze tattoos. And what this research showed was that the pigments in the tattoos, and they were looking at titanium dioxide, which is the second most common pigment used in tattoos. Anyway, titanium's very safe, we think. It's used in food additives, not a problem. But the concern, but what they did discover is that microparticles, nanoparticles actually, were found in the lymph nodes of individuals who had tattoos. And that's certainly a concern. So when you have the development of these particles in the lymph nodes, there's potential for that to concentrate and even travel further in the body. But what I don't like is the idea that potentially carcinogenic particles are traveling to lymph nodes. Now, this doesn't prove anything, but like I said, I'd strongly recommend that if you've got ink, you keep it. And certainly don't view it as something that you can change without some potential downside. More to come as more research comes out. Something else about the skin, and this is regarding stem cells. It turns out that when you want to heal your skin, you have these cells called stem cells, which are a little bit like embryonic cells, although they're not embryonic cells. Anyway, these stem cells actually differentiate, change into fibroblasts, which are your skin healing cells. And they do that whenever there's an injury. Now, we know that psoriasis is a stem cell programming error in which the stem cells are overactive. So instead of just responding to trauma and differentiating into the right number of fibroblasts, in psoriasis, there's an overreaction. This is why you see psoriatic plaques on the parts of the body that are subject to a lot of friction, like the elbows and the knees. The immune system, it turns out, keeps a memory of inflammation. So the first time that you have an injury, say you get a cut and it gets infected, there's an inflammatory pathway there. It appears that if you were re-wounded, of course this is done experimentally, and you time how fast it takes to heal, that areas that are subjected to recurrent trauma heal faster. And what we've now learned is that you can close wounds almost twice as fast in areas that have already experienced inflammation, and this holds on, in mice at least, for about 6 months. Now, given how long a mouse lives, that's the equivalent of 15 years in a human. So think for a moment about calluses. Any area that's subject to a lot of friction will tend to develop a thickening of the skin, and you can imagine that this is also related to stem cells, and I bet it probably is. The researchers have actually been able to identify the name of the gene which contains the damaged sensing protein that triggers the inflammation and the upregulation of the stem cells. This may lead to some really fantastic treatments for psoriasis, which currently is treated with biological agents that suppress the immune system. The problem with these biological agents is that when you suppress the immune system, you are more at risk for nasty infections like tuberculosis if you're exposed. And even more seriously, we see a somewhat small but very concerning increase in certain kinds of cancer in people who are using these biological agents long term. I have a particular interest in this one, the psoriasis agents, because while psoriasis is bothersome to people, makes them feel like their skin looks ugly, certainly you're seeing plenty of ads if you watch commercial television for these products. I don't see that it's a life-threatening or even a quality of life-threatening thing at the same level as, say, the pain of rheumatoid arthritis and the illnesses that one gets from lupus or some of the other drugs for which these biological agents were developed. They were developed because the risk-benefit ratio made it okay to accept a small cancer risk. I'm not so sure that that's true with psoriasis, and so it bothers me to see the manufacturers so blatantly pushing this because, hey, that's the big market here, and well, that's what makes the world go round. Let's go now to some email. Is this one from Susan in Santa Cruz? Susan writes, poor Susan, worst horrible hemorrhoids. Well, I'm a 68-year-old woman who lives in a trailer, and during the hot weather a couple of weeks ago, my bathroom got to over 100 degrees for at least 4 days. It stayed hot till about 10 o'clock at night. And I stopped eating properly and drinking water and wound up with horrible constipation and horrible hemorrhoids. They're not totally gone, and the worst is the extreme pain and pressure waking me up at around 5 a.m. I can't get back to sleep again after I get up. I'm wondering if you have any suggestions. And so, Susan, the first thing I want to say is that the suppositories that your doctor can order that have cortisone are very, very helpful for hemorrhoids. You can buy Preparation H, which is just witch hazel, and that helps a little. But when you throw a little cortisone in there, and they make one that's a foam, these are prescription, but they're very, very safe, and I don't think you'd have a problem just calling your doctor and getting those called in for you. So before we leave Susan's issue, however, I wanted to point out something about being older, and older counts as above 60, you're more vulnerable to dehydration, a lot more vulnerable, and there's a bunch more stuff that can go wrong, including stroke and heart attack. So you simply cannot let yourself become dehydrated. So I'm going to give you a simple recipe, and to help you remember this, the number's 811. Now, if you have an emergency, you call 911, or if you have a question about a phone number, you call 411. But 811 is the recipe for oral rehydration solution. This works when you have diarrhea, when you have vomiting. In the case of someone who's getting dehydrated from heat, you have to drink one, for every glass of this you drink, a glass of regular water. But it really goes in quickly, and it doesn't fill your stomach, so it allows you to drink more fluid. So dehydration, bad. 811 means you take 8 teaspoons of sugar, and you put it in 1 liter of water, and you add 1 teaspoon of salt. 811. Sugar, water, salt. And it doesn't matter whether you put the sugar in first, the water in first, or the salt in first. Just get them all good and dissolved. You can flavor it with lemon juice. That doesn't interfere with it. This has been a very, very important scientific discovery. Happened back in the 60s or 70s. I think it's the 70s. And it revolutionized the treatment of dehydration and diarrhea in children in the third world, because most people had the wherewithal to boil some water, and they had some sugar and they had some salt. So you could make a huge difference. World Health Organization still distributes large quantities of these. And so strongly, strongly encourage 811 park that in your brain. Our next email from Gail in Pacific Grove, and Gail writes, ashwagandha. My brother sent me a bottle of ashwagandha. What are your feelings or perhaps experiences with this supplement? All right, now, ashwagandha is a compound that the Latin name for this is withanium somniferum. Somniferum is Latin for sleepy, and ashwagandha does help with sleep. If you are having difficulty with sleep, it's one of the herbs that can be helpful. Currently, it has most of its use for quote-unquote adrenal fatigue. And I like to call it more adrenal dysregulation because honestly, before the adrenal gland gets tired, it gets hyper. And when your adrenal gland gets hyper, you are running on stress. You are just using up your juice to get that studying done, get those projects completed, get all that work done, do all that partying. It doesn't really matter what you're doing with your time. But when you push and you push for a long time, then you feel it in your energy. But first, your sleep gets disrupted. Ashwagandha is very helpful for helping people sleep, and it also supports the adrenal glands, helps them put up with stress a little bit better and avoid becoming dysregulated. But folks, you got to get your sleep. There is nothing like it. And if you are pushing hard or you're living a high-stress lifestyle, you absolutely, positively, for your health, have to get some sleep. You have to allow time. You have to remove distractions. And if you're not being successful, pop into the herbs. But you've got to get sleep. Our next story is about one of my favorite topics, the microbiome. So the microbiome is this wonderful mix of bacteria that exist inside and on our body. We have protective bacteria on our skin that help prevent us from getting skin infections. We have protective bacteria in our gut, which promote all sorts of things, regulate the immune system. They've been linked with the good bacteria has been linked with normalizing weight, normalizing depression, helping anxiety, things you wouldn't expect, helping with obesity, helping with diabetes, just a host of diseases, including a lot of autoimmune diseases that are influenced by their microbiome. So people who have an inflamed gut often have an adverse microbiome. And one of the things you do in functional medicine all the time is try and fix the gut. And it's always a dilemma. Do you use antibiotics and sort of, you know, flamethrower the yard with the equivalent of Roundup and then replant? Does that even work? In the case of fecal transplant, which is the scientifically validated way of fixing the microbiome, it's messy and difficult. But yeah, that works, and you don't even have to wipe out the microbiome. But what is being done by most people, because most people don't have access to fecal transplant, is some sort of antimicrobial therapy and some sort of replacement with probiotics. And the hope is that, not that those probiotics are going to be the only thing in your microbiome, you've got over 1,000 things in there, but that they'll sort of act like ground cover and keep the bad guys from moving back in while the healthy guys that you should have in there manage to regroup. Researchers in the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis have been studying the microbiome and looking particularly at a type of cell called T regulatory cells. T regulatory cells are what prevent autoimmune disease. They are the cells that calm down the immune response, and we know that they're defective in autoimmune disease, so fixing T regulatory cells is something like a holy grail. In the August 3rd version of the journal Science, these researchers were able to show that they could promote T regulatory cells in the intestines by feeding mice an amino acid called tryptophan. Now, if you've got probiotics in your cupboard, you might want to check and see if you've got any Lactobacillus reuteri in the mix. That's R-E-U-T-E-R-I. And Lactobacillus was found by these researchers to promote and raise the T regulatory cells. Researchers also discovered that the study mice who were more tolerant, this was a series of studies, so that to inflammatory compounds had higher levels of 6 bacterial species, and they set out to see what you could use to feed these bacteria to make them thrive. And the winner was tryptophan, an amino acid that is often given for sleep. They also found that if they grew the Lactobacillus reuteri in liquid and transferred small amounts of the liquid without even the bacteria into immature immune cells from mice, they would differentiate into the T suppressor subtype. So we should all be eating more tryptophan, especially if we have inflammatory bowel disease or if we have autoimmune disease in general. The researchers were able, just by doubling the amount of tryptophan in the diet, to increase the number of regulatory cells by over 50%. So adding a scoop of tryptophan or taking 500 milligrams or so at bedtime might be enough to make the difference. But if you want to do it with food, nuts, eggs, seeds, and beans all have relatively high quantities of tryptophan. And of those, there's got to be at least one thing that you like. Let's go now to our first caller. It is Emma from Santa Cruz. Hello, Emma. You're on the air.
Hi. I just want to ask you about the benefit of apple cider vinegar. If you may please explain if this is something really good for your gut.
Yes, I'd be happy to. So apple cider vinegar is one of the, first of all, it's a fermented food. And I think that's super, super important. If you're drinking the apple cider vinegar with the quote unquote the mother in it, you're actually getting beneficial bacteria right away, just directly in there. And so make sure you shake it up and then pour it out. So that's one. And when you go, like, I'm a bit of a Pinterest addict. I have to admit to that. So I'm a bit of a Pinterest addict. And one of the things that you find is, all of the thousands of things that apple cider vinegar does. And I haven't actually gone and done a literature research to see how much of these are true. But in terms of the gut, we know it's true. And apple cider vinegar has a low pH. Many people eat on the run, or they're under stress, or they're having an argument, or they're worrying about work, or they're grabbing 5 minutes and just wolfing down their meal. And those are all things that interfere with your stomach's ability to make stomach acid. You see, the way stomach acid works, there's a signal from the brain. And if you have a high level of adrenaline, that signal is blocked, and so you won't send a good signal to the stomach to make stomach acid. Without the stomach acid, among other things, you don't kill the bad bacteria that are present in your food. There are soil organisms. If you eat a raw salad, there's going to be some soil organisms in there, even if you've rinsed it. It's not a problem as long as you're making stomach acid. People who don't make stomach acid for long periods of time tend to develop overgrowth in their intestines of things like yeast. Candida is very commonly found. They also have overgrowth of bacteria in the small intestine, and one of the symptoms of that is a lot of gas after eating. So if you suffer from gas after eating, and particularly raw foods, that's definitely an indication that you might do very, very well with a little apple cider vinegar. Now, how to take it is a bit of a dilemma. And my recommendation is that you dilute it about a finger of apple cider if you were, let's say, have a regular standard drinking glass, and then about between 4 and 8 ounces of water. And that does not interfere with its activity in the stomach or in the gut, but it brings it down a little bit. Recently, I've been seeing also a lot of drinks that are like apple cider vinegar drinks. They've all got sweetener in them, which I think kind of defeats the purpose if you're trying to get rid of Candida or reduce the chances of that. So I'm more in this in the school of dilute it till you can deal with the taste. I myself use it on occasions depending on what I'm eating. I'm a high stress girl, so I take a lot of stomach acid one way or another to get my meals digested. So I'm either using capsules or if it's convenient, I'll use the apple cider vinegar.
How many times do you recommend it's drank? Or is it okay to be drank on an empty stomach or even before the meals? What would be the best
fine to do before the meals. It depends on your goals. I don't think you need more than a quarter cup of apple cider vinegar a day. But if you took if you took an eighth of a cup, you know, with each meal, I don't think that would hurt you.
Okay, great. Wonderful. Very informative. And, thank you so much.
And thank you for the excellent question. Have a great day. Okay, so our next caller.
My name is Lee. I'm down here near Spreckles.
Hey, Lee. Nice to hear from you down in Spreckles.
Well, when you touched my button when you said apple cider vinegar.
Okay, well, let's hear from you.
It's an exciting moment, and here's something that'll turn the whole brackish, the sharpness out of it.
Oh, cool.
Without reducing it. You're reducing it, but you're reducing it in your mouth. When you take a little swig of it and hold it in your mouth and work it around in your gums and then swish it around.
Mm-hmm.
And get vigorous with it if you want. Because it's good for everything, you know. It's actually helping on your upper end, you know.
Sure, it's going to generate a lot of saliva, and it's probably going to get rid of some bad, potentially bad bacteria that might be floating around in your mouth.
And then when you swallow it, it doesn't bite you.
Okay, cool. And when you say bite you, you mean irritate the stomach?
Well, when it's going down, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of ladies and guys, too, some big pansy guys, you know, they would be surprised. I just after many years, came across it this year, and I've tested myself several times. I sure would say that it depends on whether you've just been drinking straight water for a while or something, but if your saliva is in a standard norm, that's when you might find it to be the most pleasantly more accepted and changed.
Well, thank you. That's really interesting.
Well, we're working up a Sequoia National Forest one year, and I ran into the bears trying to get into everything and bent our door over at 1 a.m. and we look out there, and when the light hit the bear, he dropped the eagle lunch pail, but he got the half a sandwich. But I wanted to thank the people at the gate after being there for 2 months. And I look up at this white pole next to my door of my truck, and I say, oh, I got it. And so I'm going to give it to you and all. Nice big California bear hug. for being on. I'm going to get off, and I'm going to listen to you all because I'm enjoying hearing what you're saying.
Well, thank you so very much for the down-home advice. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Down home, it's going.
Okay, good on you.
Bless you now.
Bye-bye.
You're really on it, you know. I mean, when you're telling these folks, you're giving them more life.
There you go. You're taking taking life in and promoting that life that's inside you. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you kindly.
Bye-bye. Right now, we're going to talk about, continue on our thread with the microbiome. Talk about walnuts, and no, there is no funding from the walnut growers of California, but you know, walnuts are actually very rich in omega-3 fatty acids and fiber. They contain a high level of antioxidants. What you may not realize is that they are actually insulin sensitizing. So walnuts improve diabetes. They're an excellent thing if you're going to eat nuts. Walnuts and almonds are the best ones, and walnuts are the best of all for making your cells more sensitive to your insulin. But walnuts also contain, as we were talking about, lots of tryptophan because they're high protein, and they increase the beneficial bacteria like Lactobacillus reuteri that we previously talked about on the other study. There's also evidence, and this is statistical epidemiologic stuff, and I'll just stop for a moment and say, whenever you ask a bunch of people what they ate 5 years ago, you're not going to get all that accurate. So really, it's sort of, you ask people, do you eat walnuts? Do you like walnuts? Do you eat walnuts once a week or every day? There you might get a reasonable history. So whenever you're doing epidemiology on food, it's always tricky. But we'll take it as read that there is good data of that level of good that you can reduce your risk of cardiovascular disease. And it, in animals that are fed higher doses of walnuts, they actually see slower tumor growth and improved brain health. So I'm not sure about improved brain health in humans, but since we're an animal, I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. The actual research was supported by the California Walnut Commission, but I am not supported by them, and I gave you the story anyway. So this is a study out of China looking at really, really healthy people and taking a look at their microbiome. You had a group of, they had 1,000 Chinese people. The age ranges were from 3 to 100. And what they were looking at particularly is the people who were between 90 and 100 and had no health issues that beyond being 90 years old. But these were people who were not taking any kind of pharmaceutical. And they had the same diversity of gut microbiome as healthy young people in their 30s. So that's really a pretty amazing bit. And so if you remain healthy, your microbiome remains healthy. Or maybe, more accurately, we should say, if your microbiome remains healthy, you remain healthy. So I really want to encourage you, eat your fiber, avoid antibiotics unless it's a very bad infection, and then repopulate your gut aggressively with probiotics and fermented foods. Maybe even get checked for gut diversity. There's now DNA probes where they can just take a sample of poop and they can run it through an analyzer and tell you how many different organisms you've got, how many different ones is what we call diversity. And there is strong association with gut diversity and just about, well, inverse correlation, which means the higher the gut diversity, the lower the other thing. Inverse correlation with just about every disease that's been studied. So let's all become gut gardeners and see where we get. So we've got another caller, and this one is Suzanne in Santa Cruz. Hello, Suzanne. Welcome to the show.
Hi, yeah, I would like if you would address a certain thing that I'm battling right now, the C. diff problem.
Is that C. difficile, Clostridium difficile?
That's it.
Yes.
That's it.
Oh, I'd be happy to.
That's what I'm battling. I was unfortunately had to be on antibiotic drip for a long period of time, and I survived it for a while, but now I find that I am battling the C. diff.
All right.
And could you address that for me, please?
Yeah, sure. Let me ask you a few detailed questions. Are you currently suffering from active diarrhea?
Yes.
Okay. So if that's the case, they'll usually do a stool test to confirm the presence of C. difficile toxin. Did you have that test, and was it positive?
Yes.
Okay. And so treatment for this typically is a drug called vancomycin, which is never given orally, except in this circumstance, because it does not absorb into the bloodstream. It's a drug that we use in serious, serious life-threatening infections intravenously, and it's very effective, thank goodness. We can still use it against many things that are developing disease resistance. But in the case of the C. difficile, Most C. difficile is still sensitive to vancomycin. So we can give it orally, and it stays in the gut, and that's good. And we can protect the kidneys, because this is a drug that's very hard on the kidneys, but not if you're giving it orally. Unfortunately, a certain percentage of people relapse. So we treat them for the 2 weeks that we should treat them. Sometimes they do 3 weeks by protocol. You do well, the diarrhea goes away, and then a few weeks or months later, it recurs. One of the things that after you're treated, you're going to really need to avoid is antibiotics for a while. And you're also going to need to be very aggressive about your gut gardening and tending your microbiome. At this point, you're early on. Have you started the oral treatment yet?
I went through a 1 week, and I seem to be improving with the oral vancomycin, and now I've relapsed.
Okay, so and this is your first relapse, yes?
Yes. And I want to know what your opinion is on how I should deal with it from here on out.
Okay.
Go back to the vancomycin.
You go back to the vancomycin, and
okay.
You get and think of this as mold on your bathroom ceiling, all right? You're going to have water in your bathroom. That's kind of what it's for. There's going to be steam in your bathroom. That's kind of the point of the bath part of the bathroom name. So that's a great environment for mold. And if you just don't do anything to prevent it, like use an evacuation fan to pull the steam out of the room or get up there with regular, I use white vinegar for the purpose, squirt it on the ceiling above the shower or the bathtub, you're going to have mold.
Uh-huh.
So think about the C. difficile from now on in. Think of this as mold. It's going to be there unless you make it unhappy.
Okay.
And so the way that you make it unhappy is you use the right probiotics. And so there's a particular probiotic called Saccharomyces boulardii. And this is actually a beneficial yeast, but the Clostridium difficile does not like this stuff at all. And it helps suppress the regrowth of the C. difficile. And we're working on all sorts of fancy things, but for the advice that I can definitely give you that is in the category of won't hurt you, likely to help you, is about 1,500 milligrams of this stuff a day. You can buy it in capsules and just take that three times a day. Don't take it with a hot liquid. Don't take it with really hot, piping hot food, but it doesn't have to be taken with a meal. You can take it on an empty stomach if you want. It dissolves in your gut and just, so it'll grow for a while, and that will prevent or reduce, you know, we can't say prevent because, you know, we need the studies and we need to figure out what the optimum dose is. I'm giving you a ballpark dose here, but it will reduce the chance of further recurrence. If you do get another recurrence, you need to request a fecal transplant. And they are being done. They're being done up at UC and Stanford. I don't think they're being done locally, but there is nationally, there is a lab that has the permission of the FDA to give out, you know, FDA-certified poop, if you can believe it. And so you can have yourself inoculated with bacteria, with all of the bacteria that suppress C. difficile, and get back yourself. It's kind of like garrisoning the fort. You know, you're in Indian country, and there's one, what was that movie, Dances with Wolves? There's like one guy running the fort. He's not going to be able to fight off the Indians. But, sorry, politically incorrect metaphor. Please don't send me an email about it. But if you've got like, you know, 60 gun-toting soldiers at that fort, the Indians will probably make themselves scarce. So what we're doing is we're re-garrisoning your defenses with the Espolardi and the other probiotics.
Can you kind of spill that one in particular that you're referring to? Because I do take probiotics, mm-hmm. but
this
I'm
one
not
won't.
Sure
yeah,
about.
This one, because it's not a bacteria, you won't find it usually in the kit. So let me go ahead and do that. I'm just going to take a second here. I'm not that good a speller, but I have a friend named Google who's really good at it. So okay. It's SACCHARO and then MYCES. Okay? I know. Heck of a name. So that's the first word. And then the second word is Boulardi, like we're going to spell boulevard, but BOULARDII.
BOULARDII.
Yeah, you got it.
Got it.
All right. So that's what you need to look for. And you can find it at any health food store. So get them to help you if you're having difficulty locating it. But it's usually, sometimes it's mixed in, but it's not going to be mixed in at the dose that you need. So you're going to need a big wonkin' dose of that plus other probiotics because you want the good bacteria as well as the beneficial yeast.
Okay. And as far as anything dietary that I should definitely stay away from?
You want to get lots of fiber because that promotes the good bacteria. And
right,
I'd probably be doing some apple cider vinegar, maybe some sauerkraut, certainly some yogurt without sugar, you know, get the kind that has no added sugar. Every day, you know, a couple of fermented foods, but it's the fiber that really helps things grow. So sauerkraut, apples are good, root vegetables. So like if you eat a carrot one day and eat a potato the next day and eat a beet the next day, so keep giving, those are full of fiber and very good for you know, you're putting in probiotics, but they got to have, if they're going to reproduce and grow the clone, you got to have lots of fuel. And now you want to avoid alcohol. You want to avoid animals that are not organic. So because they're going to have antibiotics in the meat.
Right.
So you want antibiotic free meat. And I would take it easy on sugar. You know, you can have some sugar. I'd probably go whole grain breads, not the, you know, white spongy breads. You don't have to be super bread free or anything like that, but try to go with the whole grain versions of it and not too much, right? Because that tends to feed the bad bacteria.
Right. Okay, like brown rice is good.
Yeah, better than white rice and in moderation anyway.
Okay. All right. That really gives me a lot of fuel to work on.
Good. I'm glad because it's super important for us to protect our microbiome, and you're in a very compromised situation right now, and you definitely want to avoid that third relapse.
Oh,
or second relapse, rather. Yeah, you just don't want to get on that merry-go-round.
Okay. All right. So now, and would you advise doing all this that you've just outlined for me? And going back to a second
course of antibiotics, you gotta kill the stuff. Once it grows, once the ceiling's full of mold, you gotta clean it off.
Okay.
All right.
So going back to the oral, that go is okay.
Yes.
To do.
It is.
Okay.
It is. All right. Good luck to you.
Oh, thank you for your information.
You're welcome, Suzanne.
Okay. Bye bye.
I want to do a brief shout out to this email, and this is from her name truncated, but she's in Bonaire, in Kralingjik, Bonaire, Dutch Antilles. And Carol is her name. Carol's been having some real problems since she moved to the Caribbean. She had a bladder infection while she was getting there, and once she arrived, lots of heat, tropical island. Suddenly she's got bumps under her skin on her lower legs with permanent sores. Then she's got liver-like spots at the panty line and between her legs. That probably is heat rash. And then she's got eczema on the inside of her wrist. Poor thing, her skin's just going crazy. And she has a history of eczema. So I'm just going to skip over Carol's other details. I just want to tell you, Carol, because I know you checked the podcast, that I think you have erythema nodosum. This is a drug rash that happens after treatment for urinary tract infection with the most common drugs. So I think those spots on your lower legs are that. I want you to look up erythema nodosum, We'll have that on the website. You can look at the spelling. And also look up chiggers and sand fleas, because they can also cause rashes that might represent the ones you're having on your lower legs. I'm worried that those are going to get infected. Other advice I can give you goes back to the gut gardening. Be sure while you're there, you should eat sauerkraut. There's cabbage pretty much everywhere on the planet. You can learn to make your own sauerkraut. Learn to ferment vegetables. There are lots of recipes online. You don't need probiotics if you can learn to ferment vegetables, and just about anybody can do that. Right now we're on Bob. Bob in Washington.
Hello.
Hello.
Questions about, I've been living with prostate cancer for about 18 years now. When I was diagnosed, I was too far advanced for surgery. I went through a course of radiation and hormone therapy. That did a great job. A few years ago, my PSA numbers started to go back up. They put me back on Lupron. And then in the past year, even though I was on Lupron, the numbers started going up again. And so they moved me. They now classified me as advanced. And my oncologist tells me she expects me to metastasize within a year or so.
Now, did they remove your prostate? I'm sorry.
No, they did not.
Okay.
Surgery was not an option. They did external beam radiation.
Okay, good.
And,
right. So when she says that she's expecting metastasis, what she means is she's expecting to find it, but that it's probably already there.
Right.
That's the implication here.
But at this point, she's just treating numbers, not tumors, because a scan didn't turn anything out.
So we don't know where it is. We just know something's pumping out PSA.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere. And that's a bad situation to be in. Are you familiar with Dean Ornish's work?
Not around prostate cancer, no.
All right. Well, he has done some really amazing work on prostate cancer, and he's come up with a diet and exercise plan, as well as a bunch of nutrients that shift the ground. Basically, the concept is that you make wherever it is, we want to make it as unhappy as possible. We don't want it to, just like with the C. difficile, we want an environment that discourages further growth. And there are things that you can do with that in alternative medicine that you really need to look at. Now, I don't usually just do this, but I really would encourage you, go see a functional medicine doctor, come see me, go see somebody, because you're in a situation where there are things you can do to slow this down, but they're extensive and I can't cover them in a radio call. Okay?
I understand. Okay, great.
All right. Bye to you now.
Thanks for your help.
You're
Bye-bye.
Welcome. Bye. Okay, let's see if we can get Diane back.
See, I'm calling in regard to a sty in the eye. Could you wash it with colloidal silver, or would that be a help?
Well, that wouldn't be a bad idea because it'll reduce bacteria, but it's basically a boil. And so the colloidal silver is not really going to get down into the gland. Think of it as an eye pimple, and you'll be pretty close to what it is. The best treatment is still heat and warm compresses. Generally, it'll come to a head in a day or two and drain on its own. If it doesn't, then by Monday, you probably want to go in to your doctor and get it lanced. But the warm compresses will make it throb a bit more, but that's really what you need to be doing.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, and I'm glad we could help you and get you back on the air.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. I'm going to go ahead and do one more email. This is from an anonymous email in Sunnyvale regarding bone health. Dear Dr. Don, I'm a 30-year-old female with osteopenia and recently suffered a proximal anterior tibial stress fracture with lots of edema. What can I do to speed up healing and optimize bone health? Well, Annie, that's for anonymous, of course. First of all, get your vitamin D level checked. Make sure it's at least 50. It should be between 50 and 80 for optimum calcium absorption. And be sure you're taking calcium and magnesium, about 500 milligrams of each every day. Make sure you're getting some vitamin K2. That's going to help with your absorption of the calcium. And I like about 500 micrograms of vitamin K2 when you're trying to heal a fracture, drop it down afterwards. And there is some great acupuncture. If you were over here, I'd be telling you to get acupuncture with kidney and spleen tonification and see if you can find someone who's been trained in osteopuncture. This is a technique where you actually put a needle right in the area where the fracture is and another in the muscle, and you control the strength of the electrical signal. But what you're doing with this is you're stimulating blood flow. And we can show that this happens using Doppler ultrasound. There are studies that prove that you increase blood flow to the area that you're targeting. And also, it really helps reduce edema. So that's the kidney and spleen tonification with osteopuncture. And if you go to the Helms Institute, and I'm not sure the website, but if you Google Helms Institute, you'll find a list of doctors who got that training, and they'd be the people that I'd be wanting you to be talking to. So Helms Institute, H-E-L-M-S, and they have a really excellent physician finder, and you can just put in your zip code, find somebody who got that training, and get yourself some osteopuncture. I think that is absolutely the best thing you could be doing. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.